whether I like it or not, there's an Alabama theme to All Marine Radio, and especially to post-traumatic winning. And here's one of the reasons why. Joining me from the great state of Alabama, a farmer, Jack Riley. So, there's so many people that have crossed my path as a part of post-traumatic winning that are from Alabama. Is that a coincidence, or is it something in the water or the oxygen or the dirt down there?
Ah, hey, I tell you what. You know, when you're from a state that's won so many national football championships as we have, you know, we've just got those crystal balls stored in the foot lockers.
So it's a place of champions. Is that what you're telling me? This is just the way we do it down here?
You've never heard that theme song you play until you've been in Bryant-Denny Stadium there at the university, and they start blaring that thing right before kickoff. I mean, you got the whole stadium rocking then.
I've seen videos of it, and that looks like a pretty good time. When you hear let me play it here. I don't need to articulate it, but when you hear, right, when that crowd hears this. Now, they straight up lose their minds, yes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you got everybody on their feet. And hey, you got that good old group, you know, that you know, that song's old, but still
it's the song, right?
Oh, man, yeah. Yeah, then you got the group Alabama that sings My Home's in Alabama.
Southern born and Southern
bred,
right?
They always play that one also.
So I for whatever reason, there's just been so many people that have influenced post-traumatic winning that, you know, you, Gene Sledge, a Lance Corporal by the name of Luke Weichel, his mother, Libby, they both live in the Huntsville area. Another Marine, Matt Kiker, he lives in Mobile. And so this thing keeps taking me back to Alabama. But I'm good with it. I mean, I lived in Alabama for a couple summers when I was a kid. So while I don't consider myself a native to the state, I'm good with it. So I've been aboard the USS Alabama, I just find it ironic that the state has such a big presence here so I honor it. I play that song to open the show sometime. And then anybody from Alabama that's listening sends me a two-word text message or email most of the time. Hell yeah.
Or Roll Tide.
Exactly. One of the two. For those of you who don't know Jack Riley, all you got to do is type in Riley and listen to any of the interviews that Jack has done on this program. And let me tell you, they're fantastic. He is he's one of my heroes because Jack was doing what I was doing a long time ago, what I do a long time ago. He was helping people. He says a thing, and I'll play the audio. Gene Sledge says something too. And Jack says that, you know, you have to live your life in a way that honor those that, you know, were with you and died. And at the end of the program every day, I play a song called by Steve Winwood called Back in the High Life. And the reason I play it as a reminder that it's our job to live great lives for those of our comrades who didn't come home. So Jack and I first met after I did an interview with General Butch Neal, who was a lieutenant in Jack's company, India Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, the Flaming Eye, as I've come to know it. They get involved in a battle of Gatlin's Corner, and I did an interview with General Neal about that. And so Jack heard it, and then he sent me an email, said he thought it was a great interview and thanked me very much for doing it. And I said, well, hey, why don't you come on? And so that started my relationship really with Jack, and he's come on, and our conversations have gotten broader. And then I can't remember not too long ago, within the last year, he told me that he knew Gene Sledge, another Alabama guy. And so I wanted to have him on after I found these. So I'm perusing stuff about Sledge, and I find this digital archives at Auburn. And then for whatever reason, I find these interviews that Studs Terkel did with Gene Sledge as Terkel researched his book, The Good War, that would become a bestseller. I think he's doing the interview in 1984. Sledge's book came out in 1981. And so Studs Terkel goes down and interviews him. And so I sent those to Jack. First of all, because you knew Gene Sledge, it must be wonderful to hear his voice and listen to him talk about those things with Studs Terkel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, really. And that's just – that was just Gene. I mean, that's the way he talked. I mean, it just reminded me of so many of our lunchtime conversations that we had.
So how did you meet him?
First time I ever met Gene, we were having a program that the Birmingham Kiwanis Club does every year. They honor the new incoming commandant, or a three or four star general coming in. But this particular, there was a reception ahead of this meeting that was just for Marines only. So I took off from work, went downtown, and went up for the meeting, and everybody just, slapped the name tag on their lapel of their suit. And so I had a Purple Heart lapel pin in my suit. And this fella comes up to me and says, where'd you get that? And I told him it was in Vietnam. And so he asked me about it. He says, well, is that the only one you got? And I said, well, no, sir. I got three of them all together. And so he starts asking me more questions about it. And I finally looked down and noticed that his name tag just says Gene Sledge. And then it just hit me.
Now, how did
and
you?
I said,
now, well, hold on. How did you know? What year is this? Has he written his book yet? How do you know?
Oh, yeah, his book's out. Okay. I'd already bought the book and read the book.
Ah.
And so I look down and I see his name, and I just say, "Are you Sledgehammer?" And he just grinned and said, "Yeah." Yeah, that was my nickname. And I told him, I said, well, Mr. Sledge, he said, stop me right there. He said, I'm not Mr. He said, you call me Gene. And I said, well, Gene, I bought your book, and it was just fantastic. It, I thought it was the best written book by somebody who was in a line company that I've read, about World War II. And I said, I loaned the book to someone who I don't even remember now who I loaned it to, and they never returned it. And that's, that's all I said. And he said, well, that's too bad. about 3 days later, the incoming mail there at the office, I'd given him my business card. There on my desk in, folded brown paper, is a book that, and I sent you a copy of the introductory page where he just signed it.
Right.
And, but he said later, I said, oh, I wasn't expecting you to send me a free book. He said, oh no. He said, I have several of them. And I said, well, you do know this is on the commandant's reading list. He said, it is. I'm sure he knew that. But,
right.
But anyhow, he was such a, and I said, well, Gene, you know, I know several people that went to what used to be the Montevallo State Teachers College, and then it became Montevallo University, or the University of Montevallo. And but several students, and including some that go to church with us currently, that were students of his at the university, and they all just loved him. And but Gene was he was a small guy. He was, you know, very slight in build, very soft spoken, just a super smart, but the type of guy that you just felt like you knew. I guess since I'd read his book, I just felt like I knew him, not just to know him, but I really knew him. And not from a professional sense, but just as a Marine. And I had nothing but the highest admiration for him.
Well, it is, and his book is unique in that era, in that it's one of the first that actually describes vividly what his experience was like.
Oh yeah, I asked him about that because even in Vietnam, we were warned not to be keeping any diaries or things like that because the enemy, you know, if it were to get in enemy hands, they could use it and all of that. And of course, Gene said the same thing, but just like probably you received when you went through Quantico, you know, we were all given a little New Testament by the Gideons. And he said he used that little New Testament, and he wrote notes around the margins of just about every page of that thing. So he was able to, you know, remember dates and places and names, and especially names, because some of the guys there, like he said, they didn't last long. You know, they got so many replacements in after, you know, after landing at Peleliu and Okinawa that.
The amount of detail that's packed into every day, right, is astounding. I want to play some audio from Gene and this conversation, because I think one of the most interesting things, Jack, in this thing is Turkle's looking at this through a lens of a writer that's going to write a story, right?
Yeah.
And then you hear Gene Sledge trying to talk to him about it. And
because Turkle don't understand really what he's. Right. Yeah.
He gets K-bar confused with the B-A-R, right?
Yeah.
And so it's funny in that, well, bar, that's, you know, bar. Is that the K-bar? No. One's a fighting knife. One's a machine gun. It is funny. But you can hear, and then Turkle will, he hears Sledge say certain things. And it sticks in his head as either a phrase or a headline or something like that. So this is the two of them, and this is about 60 seconds of them talking.
As we're here talking, write this.
Oh, hold on. Let me get it to the right spot.
I hope so.
Well, what did you say when you said just then, do I see an iron in?
Well, in the fact that I'm interested in birds and biological science and was a combat Marine on the front lines. It's amazing, Studge. You know, people tend to think of birds and bird watchers as being sort of, you know, as not quite macho, you know, and so forth. Because I think that the ridiculous thing is there was nothing macho about the war at all. We were just a bunch of scared kids who had to do a job, and the reason we did it was because we were trained properly and we were patriotic. And that, I mean, you know, to me, there's no, people tell me, you know, you don't look or act like an ex-Marine. And I say, well, how's an ex-Marine supposed to act? And they have some Hollywood stereotype, you know. But the guys in my outfit, well, I think history proves were the best, or some of the best that were. All the six Marine divisions were good, but there were some real old timers in my company from stretching way back to Nicaragua and that sort of thing. And we were just a bunch of kids that volunteered and went in, and because it was a total war. And these guys, their spirit rubbed off on us. And what we were in it for was to get it over with so we could get back home and then do what we wanted to do and lead our lives.
You said a bunch of scared kids. You said these young kids.
Well, yeah, I was 19, and I think that the average age of... In the 1st Marine Division, when I went into it, it had been the Guadalcanal campaign and the Cape Gloucester campaign, and then I went into it as a replacement.
We're talking about what years, roughly, now?
Well, I went in...
Now, I want to stop that. The Sledge wasn't your typical Marine, was he, Jack?
Well, I had a Marine, and I talked to Gene about this. I had a Marine in my squad by the name of Fidel Correa's, and Fidel lives out in New Mexico. And I don't know if he's listening to this or not, but Fidel reminded me so much of Gene. And Fidel is an Indian, American Indian, and but Fidel was one of those guys that was just so quiet. And, you know, if you looked at him, and when he got out of the Marine Corps, he finished his college and became a fifth grade teacher. Spent his whole career teaching elementary school. Now, you know, you don't see too many fifth grade teachers that were Marines in Vietnam, combat Marines in Vietnam. That's just the type of guy that Fidel is, I mean, even today. And he and Gene just, I was so taken aback, you know, when I met Gene. And the first thing I thought was, man, alive, I've met Fidel Correa's twin brother here.
The he's, when you listen to the interviews, I mean, you get a sense of his, how smart Gene Sledge was, and he combines this incredible brain he's got, right? And he talked about the reason he took the notes was his father talking to him about, you know, you should record these experiences so people can understand what you went through. And then that ultimately manifests itself in a book. But he is this kind of unique, you know, deep thinker, but he's a Marine infantryman in World War II. And who happens to record this stuff and then write. But when you hear him talking to Turkle right there, you know, when he talked about, well, what is a Marine supposed to be? You know, am I somehow less because I'm smart or something like that? And to me, it's a very, very interesting exchange.
Well, and it brings up a very good point. And in fact, Gene and I talked about this being stereotyped. You know, most Marines, you know, people think, well, here's a macho guy. He's always drinking beer and getting in trouble or what have you. But, you know, goodness, I've got these Marines from my company that's in every profession you can think of that are, you know, very successful, honorable people, college professors. Two of the officers I served with became college professors. And one of the, later on, one of the grunts who ended up being a squad leader in first platoon, he's currently a professor of history out at Texas A&M University. So, you know, these guys, though they were enlisted, they were plenty smart. They had, of course, you know, we had some that had problem reading a compass or a map, but By the same token, we had some guys that were super smart, read all the time. You know, when you got a guy who's like we were over there, it was nice to even have a book that had the front and the back tore out, and you'd read it anyway.
Right.
You didn't know how it started, and you didn't know how it ended, but you'd still read it.
Hey, Jack, let me ask you a question, because Sledge just mentioned that he was 19. One of the things that I've found, I don't know, surprising would be the right word, is how young most Marines were in Vietnam. You were one of the older guys.
I had two birthdays over there. I turned 22 and 23. But most of the guys were, they were 18, 19, 20. They were, they were younger. I guess having a little, I'd been to college for a couple of years and had a little bit more education, but goodness, all of the guys that I had the honor of serving with, it's plenty smart, and thank goodness understood tactics, because my guys in particular, I know they got tired of doing immediate action drills, but immediate action drills save your life.
Right.
But you go over them and over them and over them until, when the rounds start flying, they know what to do.
Right.
You can't always tell them what to do because of the noise, but they know what to do.
And for those of you who don't know, immediate action drills are those things you do on contact, whether it's an IED explodes or whether you're taking machine gun sniper or fire or sniper fire. What do we do immediately, whether we walk into an ambush? So what do we do,
right,
and how do we get our asses out of this? How do we just right the ship and the little things you have to do? And the first thing, when we would do these things, everybody dives to the ground, but you need people to talk. What are you seeing? I mean, help me figure this shit out, right? Because I don't know what the hell's going on either. And we need you to yell. Just tell me what you see. Nothing, nothing, nothing over here. And all of a sudden, everybody's head slews that way. And so anyway, it's the blocking and tackling of an infantry squad, immediate action drills. Let me play you another little cut. This is Sledge talking about, this is the K-bar little thing.
This was funny.
And talking about, actually, this is about POWs and the Bushido code, the K-bar thing.
Oh, okay.
All right. So
okay.
Did many of us to enlist, but when you get down to the real elemental aspects of it, what it was all about was just a matter of survival.
Yeah.
And the war that I knew it was totally savage and without quarter. I mean, there was no... We never took prisoners unless an officer made us take them.
Really?
Yeah. Because the hatred was so intense. Because, you see, the Japanese fought by a code which they thought was right, which was the code of Bushido.
Bushido?
Yeah, Bushido.
Meaning?
Code of the warrior.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And they would reach perfection through perfecting the art of being a warrior, you see. And so to them, it was no surrender. And this was, the papers talk about no surrender and this, that, and the other, but you don't really comprehend it until you get out there and fight people who are faced with an absolutely hopeless situation, and you got them cornered, but they will not give up.
And then, of course, there was this feeling here, these young kids, obviously unsophisticated, naive young kids who join the Marines, they're also scared. At the same time, don't want to let their buddy down. Something happens to them and their attitude toward the others, the Japanese. They develop a sort of hatred.
You mean the Japanese?
No, I mean, I'm talking about the American kids.
Oh, yeah, well, of course, if you tried to help wounded Japanese, they usually responded by detonating one of their grenades and would kill themselves, which is typically what they would try to do to prevent being captured.
Pretty amazing when you think about being 19 in that situation. Let me ask you a question relative to that. First of all, when you hear him talking about that, what thoughts go through your head, Jack?
Oh, man, the fact that we always assumed, you know, a guy was alive and that he had a grenade under him or he had a grenade in his hand or he had a knife in his hand. Of course, converse to what Gene said there, where he was talking about the anger of that all the men had. And this primarily came about because they had seen prisoners tortured, and not just killed, but tortured. And if you've never seen a fellow Marine tortured to death, I mean, it's something you just won't ever, ever forget. And it does put this hate in you. And I'll admit, while I was over there, I hated them. I genuinely hated them. And it was because of what I saw them do, what I saw them do to kids, their own people. So it's easy. It's easy to hate in battle. But we always tried to capture those that we thought, you know, were leaders. Of course, their leaders always tried to act like they were a peon. But it was just trying to capture those. And we weren't able to capture a whole lot. Now, the VC were much easier to capture. They'd give up pretty easy. They were just conscripts anyway. But the NVA, that was a different story. The part about hate that Gene talks about, we talked at length about that and how you overcome that over a period of time. Because, you know, give you an example, I met my wife on R&R in Hawaii. Well, the day before.
Well, hold on. You were married when you went, so you didn't. Yes. You're not saying that you met her while you were on R&R. You're saying that she joined you in Hawaii while.
Correct.
You were already
correct.
Married. Okay.
She flew from Alabama to Hawaii, met me there. But you know, the day before, I was out in the bush. And the day after I got back, I was out in the bush again. And having that mindset of that you have to have, you know, in combat, man, that was tough. That was tough. And it was tough. The toughest part for me was not being an animal when I was with her. Because literally in combat, you know, you're pretty much, you're there to kill the enemy and survive. And the Marine Corps uses some very descriptive language that you're prone to use some on your program sometimes.
What?
And
what are you talking about?
But anyhow, those types of situations in your head, and Gene admitted, you know, boy, he had a tough time. He wasn't married at the, you know, when he returned from the war, and he had his parents, but you can't talk to your parents. I'll give you another example. We had a young man that went into the Marines that I'd known all his life. I've seen him grow up. I've mentored him before he went in the Corps and while he was in the Corps. And when he came home from Afghanistan, he came to church. I mean, the next day after he got home, he came to church, and I saw him, and I saw that look in his eye. You know, he wasn't the what he was, you know, when he was a high school kid. Everything about him was different. So I went up to him after church, and I said, we need to talk. And he said, I would appreciate that. I said, well, why don't you come to my house tomorrow morning, and we'll talk, and Jen Lou will fix lunch for us. And well, that morning turned into all day, and we didn't get through talking till 2:30 a.m. the next day.
Wow.
Because he said, I can't talk to my daddy, I can't talk to my mama, because they don't understand what I'll be talking about. How do I do that?
Right.
So, you know, we spent that whole time just talking about, all right, you're home now, how you going to deal with moving on with your life? And I was glad that I was able to be there and talk to him and talk him through that about how to do it. Because most people coming home from World War II or Vietnam or Korea, they didn't have anybody to talk to. They were very lucky if they did.
Do you think most guys need a therapist, or they just need somebody that understands that they could talk to?
You're a combat veteran. Who's the easiest person to talk to? Another combat veteran or a civilian that don't have a clue?
Another
combat veteran. And so we have a unique opportunity because we've walked in their boots. We know exactly what they're going through. So it is every veteran, especially those that saw some heavy combat. You know, if we have that opportunity, get your name out there and let people know that you'd be more than glad. Of course, they have what they call vet centers now. They don't always have a combat veteran. They have a veteran, but he may not be a combat veteran.
Well, some of them, depending on how they're staffed, Jack, some of them don't have veterans. You know, it depends. If they can't find them, then they don't have them. I mean, that was the original premise, that when you walked into a vet center, you're going to see veterans. But, again, I think most of them have veterans there. You know, are they combat veterans? They might be now because of, you know, all the fighting we've done over the last 20 years. But, you know, the chances are when you walked in, you know, before, that they may or may not have been. I was really lucky. I walked in, and both the guys that I spoke with were Vietnam infantry guys, and I was fortunate. Yeah, I was really lucky, and it colored my experience. A lot of guys didn't have that same experience with. That's interesting. And so, you know, again, I think that, you know, therapists certainly have a role in this, but you know, my experience in talking to people is, A, most people want to talk about it. They struggle with it. They want to talk. And B, you know, they go to see a therapist and it doesn't really work for them, so they stop going, they stop taking any medications, and they just get about living their life. And they kind of do Vietnam era mental health. They stuff it in the closet and they don't go near the door, and that's where it stays until it doesn't stay there anymore, and then they deal with it.
I've never had a situation yet where now, and I'm speaking from experience here based on our program up at General Jones's Semper Fi Odyssey program, where we're bringing in all of these veterans that they're not veterans, they're active duty, that are, you know, most of them either have severe wounds or wounds that are so severe that they're being put out. You know, they're all lifers. They want to stay in, make it a career. But their wounds are preventing them from being able to do that. So how do they transition from being a Marine or a soldier or a sailor or airman to being a civilian again? So our program up there is to teach them everything they need to know about that. But we break it up into teams, and usually we'll have anywhere from 6 to 8 on a team, and several of us that volunteer as team leaders. Well, you know, if you're going into a situation you really don't know a whole lot about it, but you've got a team leader that can be introduced to them who's walked in their boots, then they kind of perk up a little bit and say, okay, this guy's been there and done that. I need to listen to what he has to say.
Right.
So it gives us credibility right off the bat, because you know and I know that 90% of veterans are not going to open up to another person unless they are a veteran, or if it's a combat veteran, you know, another combat veteran.
Now, let me ask you about that, because I agree. But Gene Sledge asked you a question at once about, have you talked to your wife about this stuff?
Oh, yeah.
So it's interesting that, and that's one of the things I say, you need to talk. And the first person should talk to is your spouse. And people look at me like, you're out of your mind, because that's not what we get, you know, because I love you, I'll never go there with you. But it's interesting that, that Gene Sledge would ask you that question, have you talked to your wife about that? So explain that part of, we're so reluctant to share this, but Sledge comes to the conclusion that you got to share it with your wife. Talk to me about those conversations with him.
Well, Gene, of course, if you've read his book or if you've listened to Perkle's interview with him, Gene makes a comment. Well, I don't remember if it was in the interview or if it was in the book, but Gene says that he really didn't start coming to grips with things until he started writing it down. And he was just writing it down on scraps of paper to start with, you know, just notebook paper, handwritten notebook paper. And, you know, and his wife and kids, they start reading this and asking questions about it. And he's starting to explain it. Because, you know, I did the same thing. I told him, I said, look, when I got home from Vietnam, I was out of Vietnam and I didn't talk to my wife. I said, I'd been wounded at Gatlin's Corner before I went on R&R, and I never even mentioned the battle when I met my wife in Hawaii. I didn't mention it one time. And Gene said, you was protecting your wife. I said, absolutely. I did not want her being so fearful of me while I was over there that you know, she couldn't function. Well, then you get out. Well, why wouldn't you talk about it? Well, they probably wouldn't understand. They may think, because, you know, that I was in a situation, you know, and I had to kill people, that some people just look down on things like that. And so coming to the realization for me, though, was when we had our first reunion and went down. And again, I'd never told my wife anything about Vietnam. Went to the first reunion, and while I'm away from the table with a bunch of my guys, they start telling her things about what happened in Vietnam. And
well, this is Jack being dumb. He takes his wife. She's sitting with all of his squad mates,
all
right?
All my buddies.
And
he's
helped organize this thing, so he's running around doing all this stuff. And then he comes back, and she's just like, she's looking at him going, boyfriend, we got to have a conversation.
We had to talk Listen, we had to talk for about 700 miles. So,
There's a lesson in that someplace. But so you come to grips with it, and it's kind of interesting that Sledge's conclusion, and again, this is, you know, this is circa, you know, in the 70s, right? When he comes to grips with that's what you have to do. So probably, you know, the war ends in 45. So it takes him 20 years.
That's what he was saying.
Right. Yeah. 20 years to get to the conclusion that you've got to open up to her. And because that's,
talk about it.
Because that's the best thing for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, of course, you know, it's been, since the 60s for me and, it's close to 30 years. And, of course, my boys, they didn't know, and of course, they want to know. They really want to know, but if you're not going to talk about it, what are they going to do? So,
to me, what's so interesting, and don't forget what you were just going to say, is that now in 2019 and 18 and 17, when I begin to stumble into this shit, right, and I do all these interviews, and I hear guys like you saying these things, and then I hear more people saying it, but my life didn't really change, so I spoke to my wife, and you know, as my departed father used to say, the sun shines on a dog's ass every once in a while. It occurs to me that, like, well, you have to talk to your spouse about it and let them in, because you need to feel that closeness to them, and if when you begin to be affected by your traumatic experiences, no matter where you got them, whether it be in combat or some other way, whether they be child abuse or sexual assault or however, when you begin to get affected by that, if the place you go is isolation and not intimacy, that's the exact wrong thing. But what I find so interesting about you and Gene is that you guys were country before country was cool. I mean, now I say that, and I think people, they hear it and they understand it more, and the culture's more accepting of that. But you guys came to that understanding when, you know, grandfathers fought in World War II. You know, your grandfather doesn't talk about that. Nobody talked about it, right?
You don't even mention it around them.
Right. And you so know, it's so, yeah, so to me it's very interesting that two rubes from Alabama come to the same conclusion.
Well, Gene was a heck of a lot smarter than I was and than I'll ever be.
I don't know about that. And, you guys both come to the same conclusion. No, but you know what I'm saying, Jack? That in a day and age when that wasn't what you were supposed to do, you guys, you know, he comes to the conclusion and he asks you, and you had the experience at the reunion when he asked you that? Have you spoken to your wife about it?
Yeah,
you have.
It hits the nail on the head. But the same problem exists today.
Oh my God.
Because of the macho attitude in the Marine Corps, in particular. You know, you never admit weakness. You never ask for help. You never do this. You never do that. And it's things that, boy, as the Marine Corps ever changed in that regard, but you cannot be an effective leader of anything if you don't know your people. And if you don't know your people, the only way you're going to get to know your people is to talk to them. I'll hand Captain Mike Getlin, who Getlin's Coner's named after, and he was awarded the Navy Cross, you know, when he was killed there, but Captain Getlin was an officer that I admired so much because he connected with us. I was a squad leader, and he wanted to know what I thought, and he asked me about things. A lot of my COs, you know, I don't know if I told you or not, but I think I counted it up one time. I had like 12 different commanding officers in Vietnam. And, because of rotation and because of, you know, wounds or getting killed. I had one CO for less than 30 minutes. He got shot right in the head. And just because he wouldn't listen to us and get his ass down, he got shot right in the head. But Captain Gatlin, I mean, he knew the pulse of the company. He knew how we felt. He knew what his squad leaders were capable of because he talked to us about it. And that's what a good leader does if you're in business or whatever you do. Know your people, talk to them.
You know, yeah, it's, I don't know, Jack. We need, you know, everybody hears that, know your people. But a lot of Marine leaders don't get taught, well, how do I get to know them? What do I do? What am I supposed to do? What am I not supposed to do? Because, you know, there's, you know, you told a story about you guys came back from one of your operations and Captain Gatlin had beer waiting for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
but there was
a whole six pack per man.
There was people that didn't think that was a good thing and said that was, you know, that was not good, that he was too friendly with his Marines.
Well, one of the best CEOs I ever had over there was George Navidale, Colonel George Navidale, who's retired and lives out in Vista, California now. Not too very far from you, I guess, but down in the southern part of the state.
Yeah, not far.
But George, tactically, oh man, he was Notre Dame graduate, mechanical engineer, just super smart. But tactically, one of the best officers that we ever had. And I never will forget, you know, one of our Mustang battalion commanders made the comment one time about George that, you know, he was too friendly with his troops. No. Let me back up. He cared too much about his troops. Well, let me tell you this about George. We lost six men in a battle on September the 3rd, 1966. And in George's time in India Company, those were the only six men that we lost. Now, 2 days later, we were in a battle with a battalion, and we had 66 Marines wounded, but not a single man killed. But if you got 66 Marines wounded, you know you're in a fight.
Right.
So now go a few months later, and the battalion commanders just thought he was too aggressive. So they move him back into battalion CP. Well, then he gets plugged into these other companies. Well, in June of 1967, he gets plugged into my company when their CO is removed. And right smack into just north of Gatlin's Corner in a big battle there at north of Contien, he kicked the NVA's ass, and the only person he had killed that day was one corpsman. Now, you tell me that a guy that can kick an NVA battalion's ass with a company of Marines and only lose one person killed, if he don't know how to use tactics, then you don't know anything about combat. George was a super leader, and
no, but you know, Jack, I mean, Jack, what is it? It's assholes, right? Who aren't out there with you, who are, you know, who formulate an opinion from afar, and they decide, you know, just like whoever's voice got on the radio that day and said, look, either set in the three ambushes or we'll send somebody out there that will.
To
Mike Gatlin, whoever that asshole was, and didn't say, hey, Get, this is whatever, this is, you know, whatever your battalion call sign was, you know.
Old field, whole field was arbitrating call signs.
Yeah, this is, you know, the OPSO says, hey, you do what you think is best. You're out there. You know better than anybody. That's what should always come through the radio, unless, no, we've got something else going, and you've got to get to this spot because your action enables that action. If you need something else, tell me, and I'll help you get there. I mean, that's what should come through that radio, but obviously in your case,
well, the only thing that came through the radio that day before the battle started, and it was the same thing that came over the radio for the three days. Well, third day was the battle, but the previous 2 days and up to that evening before the battle was that India Company was the bait. I mean, the colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Wilson was his name, was trying to make contact, and he was using the three platoons of India Company dangling out there by ourselves as bait. But then, you know, when the NVA took the bait, we didn't get any support.
Yeah, you're supposed to knock the shit out of them when they take the bait. That's the whole concept of dangling somebody's ass.
That's right. But all of us out there knew we were bait. Now, you got to keep motivating your men when I know and they know and everybody else in the company knew we're bait. You know, they've got to hit us before, you know, we can kill them.
Well, that's what we did. What we did a lot in Iraq and Afghanistan was we're out there moving and patrolling. And then what really the Marines are doing is they're drawing contact, and then they're trying to, and then the other guys always initiate the ambush, and then you're fighting as a counterpuncher. And then what you're trying to get your Marines to do is just fix them, and we'll smoke them with a drone. Now, let me tell you what happens in units where they fix somebody and you can't kill them. You have pissed off Marines that are out there, as Jack said, we're hanging our asses out and you're not doing what you're supposed to do. And so, some of the stories that come out of Vietnam are just awful in terms of decisions, and people's lives get put in jeopardy and people lose the only life they'll ever have because somebody's, you know, screwed
well,
up.
Well, here, you're an old cannon cocker.
No, so I'm not.
You called them in.
Oh, okay.
So,
I have that.
But you got these guys, and you know where, you know, if you can read them out, you know where they're going to be. Well, you know, some H&I fire in that area might really be nice.
Oh my! Hey, let me just tell you, if somebody's
it's
and
not
I told
like they don't know where we are. I mean, they had the scouts out there watching us for 3 days. They knew exactly where we were.
Well, I told you that. I told you this. You know, when I asked those questions about supporting arms, that, look, when you don't know, shoot something. The fact that somebody's impacting is going to get their attention, and their assumption, and this is where you have to be a little bit of a thinker, you know, in when it's confusing, their assumption is that you do know where they are. They don't know, and that you're coming for them, because that's what happens all the time. And so if you shoot, right, and because you know somebody's in danger, you know, then that's what you do. And I'd say the same thing with Bravo 19. You know, the guys got, you know, the radio operators got hit first, and so they didn't know what was going on. Well, shoot something, you know, shoot something. Yeah. You can hear the volume of fire. You know something bad's going on there. So offset it from where you know their last known position is, but send the calling card that we're coming for your ass, and maybe you'll get them to move, or you'll relieve pressure on somebody so they can do something. So, I don't know.
It was really interesting talking to Gene. And, of course, you know, just for your listeners, I had a difficult time asking Gene questions because he had 1,000 questions about Vietnam.
What was he most interested in relative to Vietnam?
He was wanting to know how we actually functioned tactically in the jungles compared to how they were moving at Peleliu, because, you know, of course, they had a it wasn't the same type jungle, and that was what I was trying to.
Yeah, most of that had all been blasted out by virtue of the amount of supporting arms, right? So you look at pictures of Peleliu, and it's not like you see what you see in Vietnam.
No. And that's what I was, you know, that he was most surprised by. I told him, you know, I had a patrol one time that was west of, it was in between, it was west of about halfway down between the rock pile and Kalu, just north of Quezon, that just about the entire patrol, we were in elephant grass that you couldn't hardly see 2 or 3 feet in front of you. And now, you talk about your old sphincter muscle drawing up, buddy, it does when you can't see 2 or 3 feet in front of you, and you know that the AK-47s will go through elephant grass pretty easy. And that's what Gene, I was trying to get Gene to understand, is we were out there supposedly snooping and pooping, trying to locate the NVA's supply routes or caches, or, you know, and if we did make contact, obviously we'd bring in supporting arms for it, air and artillery or whatever. But then we reported back to the company, and company then shares the patrol information with battalion, and battalion on up to regiment, and all of the stuff that we were seeing, this is prior to the, you know, Tet offensive of 68. You know, nobody was listening to us.
Right.
We were finding trails, heavy trails, covered trails, and it was amazing how the NVA could use bamboo to cover trails to where you couldn't see them from the air. I mean, it looked like one of them looked like a super highway, but nobody's paying any attention to us. And that was disheartening to my guys, you know. Why aren't they bringing B-52s in here and just bombing the hell out of this place?
Right.
And then Tet happens, and Quezon is totally cut off. And you know, they could only resupply it by air.
Right.
You know.
So what did you guys say? Told you so.
Well, what are you going to do, you know?
Right.
It's like every other battle we ran into up there. It's, you know, when the shit hits the fan, you just hope that you can get the support you need. At Gatlin's Corner, I was so frustrated, but I understood air was on station, and I automatically knew Artie's not going to shoot. They're not going to shoot. And that's when we were really needing support. Like Butch Neal told you, the skipper was calling in a fire mission right on our position. We were one side of the hill had already been overrun. There, where the rocket team was, and they were all amongst us. I mean, it's kind of like the old what was the old comedian's name, Clyburn or something like that. And he tells a story about going up in a tree one night, coon hunting, and he climbs up there to try to get the coon, and the coon attacks him, and. And he yells down, "Y'all shoot, shoot." And the man says, "Well, we can't shoot. You're up there." He said, "Well, just shoot up here amongst us." Well, that's what we was trying to get them to do over there. Just shoot over here amongst us, you know.
Well,
that'd be better than nothing.
You know what? You know, to me, Jack, in order to do that, you need to have guys who are professionals that are really paying attention. Really paying attention, really talking to your guys, and as you know, and again, when you send somebody into bad guy country, you know it. You know there were areas that you went to that you didn't make contact in, and then there are areas that you went into and you knew for sure We're going to be a fight. We're going to be in a fight today, boys. And when we, and yep. when you send people in there, it's incumbent upon you as a higher headquarters to know that and lean into it. Right, make sure the targets are getting laid, all that kind of stuff. How are they doing? Where are they? Everybody on this stuff, you know. And then, and this is the kind of stuff, you know, that I would do is we're going to listen on their company frequency. Okay, we're not going to make them come to us. We're not. We're certainly not going to talk on it, but we're going to eavesdrop on them to know that when they turn around, we can stick right. The 3/4-inch socket in their hand because we know that's what they're asking for. And they'll look at us and say, how the hell did you know that? We're just smart. We know it. Plus, we're listening to you, but we ain't telling you. Right?
Well, we're listening to you, and we're fussing at you for using foul language.
No, we exactly. But, no, that was the rule, right? You could never intrude, but it was for our situational awareness. And you announced what was going on. Hey, they're starting to get into it, and the other platoons are reporting, we have no comm with the company headquarters. Get the FAC. We have no comm with the FAC. Get the FO. We have no comm with the FO. Okay, what's their last position? And so I'm just saying what's frustrating to me, Gene, is that that's not that hard to fucking do if you're doing it. If that's your job every day, that's what you do. And so to me, it's a bit heartbreaking when I hear these stories. And yours isn't the only one. I mean, this shit happened on too frequent basis in Vietnam. Let me play you a couple more cuts and as we continue a discussion about Gene Sledge and Jack's relationship with Gene. And here's him talking about the K-bar and teeth and things like that.
Things were hopeless for the Germans. They surrendered.
So it was different, was it not? And there was a different attitude toward the Germans than there was toward the Japanese.
Oh, absolutely. And I've seen guys shoot Japanese wounded when it really was not necessary. And knock gold teeth out of their mouths, because most of them had gold teeth, you know. Mm. I remember one time the first time at Palaluvi, thought, well, I'll teeth, because one of my buddies he carried a bunch of them in a sock. And what you did was you took your K-bars. Here's the one I carried through the wall.
K-bar.
Yeah, K-bar, fighting knife.
It's called K-bar.
And it has a seven-inch blade. Oh,
wow.
And
K-bar because...
That's the company that built, that made it.
Yeah.
And it
bar is a as initials for something.
BAR.
Yeah.
Branding automatic rifle. But this But this is the name of the knife.
Yeah, knife. Yeah.
But we all had these, and at night you typically slept with it like this, you know. Because they would try to creep around the foxholes and all. But the way they extracted a gold tooth was to put the tip of the blade on the base of the tooth of the dead Japanese, and I've seen guys do it to wounded ones.
The wounded ones.
Yeah, that couldn't
alive.
Yeah, they couldn't resist. Yeah, you know, and put the tip of the blade on the base of the tooth and hit the, the hilt of the knife to knock it loose. And
so you said.
I mean, this sounds unreal. How could American boys do that? And so they could do it because they'd been reduced to savagery by a situation that was a matter of life or death for the Japanese and for us. And. I saw Will Lindbergh made a trip to the Philippines, and he interviewed some Americans, and he was horrified at the way the American GIs, the Army GIs, the instrument, talked about the Japanese, you know, and the boys sounded so brutal and all. Well, you know, I admire Colonel Lindbergh for his idealism, and he says, we're fighting for democracy, and these men talk like they're savages or something. He didn't say savages, but that's what we were. This is what you were reduced to in order to survive.
Even you at that one time, you said...
Well, yeah, I was going to get some gold teeth.
Even at that very beginning,
yeah. At Palaluvi, there was this Jap machine gun squad that had been knocked out by my company, and the nips, the ammo carriers and all were lying around, and I went up with my K-bar, and I leaned down to, as the troops used to say, make the extraction in the prescribed manner, and this medical, we had Navy medical corpsmen as hospital, you know, medics, the Army called, they were Army medical people. But Our Navy Medical Corps were just phenomenal guys. They were wonderful. And just, oh, my God, they were just so dedicated. And they had a terrific casualty rate. But anyway, boy, this boy's name was Kent Caswell, and bless his soul. He's dead now. He died a few years ago, but he was from Texas. And Doc Caswell said, "Sledgehammer, what are you going to do?" And I said, "Doc, I'm going to get me some gold teeth." And he said, "Well, now, you don't want to do that. Don't do that." And I said, "Well, all the other guys are doing it, you know. And, hell, I've been cutting insignias off their collars for souvenirs and this kind of thing." And he says, "But don't take the gold teeth. What would your folks think?" I said, "Well, gosh, Doc, my dad is a medical doctor back in Mobile. He might think it's interesting, you know, if I had some jabbed gold teeth, you know." And he said, "Oh, Sledgehammer, you don't want to do that." And I said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Well, because of the germs. You know, you might get germs from." And I said, "Well, I hadn't thought of that, Doc." Well, I hadn't had any biology at the time. And in retrospect, I realized that Kent Caswell wasn't worried about germs. He just didn't want to see me do that. Mm. Because, you know, it was just another step, you might say, toward just abandoning all concepts of decency. That
you see, what's...
I want you to comment, Jack. He becomes the spokesman, and Gene Sledge is kind of like two different people. He's Sledgehammer as a Mortarman in Kilo 3-5, and then he's this extremely brilliant mind, and then he uses that mind to articulate the experience of the savagery that the individual rifleman, marine, mortarman faced in World War II, and he becomes a spokesman for that group.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
The savagery of it. He, we talked about, he had read something or heard something about, people in Vietnam cutting off the enemy's ears and keeping them as trophies. And I said, "Well, that never happened in my outfit. We didn't do that." I said, we didn't mutilate bodies. We really didn't have time for stuff like that. I said, besides, you're fooling with a body that more than likely in that heat and humidity is already covered in maggots. And, the booby trap issue. Now we did, you know, and I'll admit this, we did booby trap bodies ourselves. I mean, there were booby traps. That was a big, big thing we faced down south when we were fighting a bunch of VC down there, was, having booby traps just all over the place. And I'm not talking about just a punchy stake to your foot. I'm talking about, you know, grenades on trees and trip wires all over the place. And, you know, these things are meant to kill and maim, and a booby trap is something that when it happens, the first thing you think about is taking care of your buddy. The second thing you think about is the fact there's nobody there to kill, and you're pissed off about it because there's nobody there to actually get in a fight with and kill them. And that's what a booby trap, the intent of it is to cripple and maim or kill, but at the same time, it is supposed to, you know, to work on you psychologically. And buddy, they did. And Gene talked about that. The Japanese were very good at booby trapping and with mines, but the ear thing, that was something that I later red that primarily went on with alerts down around going into Cambodia and down in the southern part of the country. But no, we didn't do stuff like that. But you do become, you are reduced in a battle. I mean, you're an animal. If you're not one, you know, you got to fight like an animal lives.
Right. And that's, but it's interesting. His observations, I think, are really interesting because, you know, he stands as these two different people, right? Sledgehammer.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And then, you know, Dr. Sledge. He embodies those two people, those two very different people in the same person, and tries to, and becomes kind of the I don't want to say the spokesman, but he articulates that life for people. And I want to say, I saw a quote that he says, "I stand as the epitome of man's folly," right? The highest evolved, the highest evolved life form, you know, reduced to murdering my fellow man, you know, and it's some quote like that, some brilliant quote that's applied to his experiences in combat, and it's and you see, you know, how fortunate, you know, people that go through that experience, they read what he writes, and it resonates deeply with them, right? I mean, you talked about your experience when you. You know, when you read the book, like, holy smokes, this guy's talking about me.
Yeah.
This guy's talking about me. Let me play one more. Let me play one more clip, and okay. I've taken up a bunch of your time today. But he says something that's very similar to something that you've told me on many occasions. So this is Gene Sledge talking about the number of casualties that his company, the Kilo Company 3-5 took.
My dad told me, don't ever feel sorry for yourself, because your outfit had it rough, as rough or rougher than anybody other than the prisoners of the Japs, but you survived, so don't feel sorry for yourself.
You were what, of how many of your original company?
Well, at Peleliu we had 65% casualties, and Okinawa we had over 100%. I guess in the two campaigns, the Gunny Sergeant Hank Boys and I counted it up, and there were about 10 of us that never got a scratch. And I never missed a day of combat.
That's 10 out of how many, would you say?
Well, you see, the company originally had 235 in it, but some went home after Peleliu, Guadalcanal veterans. And then some of the wounded came back to the company. And then you see, at Okinawa, the company hit the beach with 235 men, and the landing was unopposed there. But we landed with 235 men. But then we got 250 replacements over they just kept feeding the new men into the company. And so it would be impossible to figure what the percentages were.
It's obviously very few survived.
I mean, my luck was just almost unreal.
I was thinking, certain ones are more affected than others. I mean, more brutalized. War brutalizes. Because you're describing a scene in Okinawa, and an old woman.
So he says what you said, and that is, don't feel sorry for yourself. You were lucky, right? You have a similar thing that you say, Jack, in terms of, you know, it's your responsibility to come home and live your life in a manner that honors them. And I know, because I play it on the show every day, you and he very much alike in reaching that same conclusion about how you have to go about living your life.
Of course, Gene, where he's talking about how many casualties they had, I asked him, you know, if he knew how many of those were dead, and, you know, how many of those had actually been killed, versus, you know, that were had to be taken out of the field because of the wounds. And of course, that was a hard number to come up with. Back in World War II, you know, you got a serious wound. All they could do is put a little sulfur powder on it and put a compression bandage on it and hope you got to get to a doctor. So most of theirs died. whereas most of ours, that even with serious wounds, we were able to get them, medevac them to a field hospital, to where they got at least some life-saving treatment before they were sent on to the repos or NSA down at Marble Mountain. But he was very interested about my company, about how many we'd had killed and versus how many we had wounded. And I told him about my first day with my company when the sergeant major gave us our welcome to 3-9 speech. And the sergeant major said, how many of you guys are wanting to win a medal over here? Well, of course, nobody was stupid enough to hold their hand up. But then he says, well, I can assure you that you'll get one medal over here, and it'll be a Purple Heart, because just about everybody in this battalion gets at least one. And I immediately thought to myself, that is not the one I want to get. And it just tells you that you're going to be in it, and you're going to be, in it in a big way. And for Gene, I told Gene about one of my guys that was a fire team leader for me, outstanding Marine. He fought with the 26 Marines before he came to 3-9. You know, it was one of those deals, Mac, where all these battalions were sent to Vietnam relatively close, time-wise. So you were going to have guys that were going to be leaving after 13 months in separate units, and it was going to leave some companies just decimated with experience.
Right.
So, but I ended up getting John into my squad. And I made him a fire team leader because he had his act together. He was a good Marine. And John told me that he actually spent his entire 13 months and saw some of the heaviest combat in Vietnam and never got a Purple Heart. I said, good night, John. How'd that happen? Remember,
yeah,
how that could ever happen.
The millions of pieces of metal that are flying through the air over there.
And you don't get one.
Never
got a scratch.
Right.
Nope, never got one.
No, if you do the probability on that, I mean, it's infinitesimal, right? At some point, you're going to collide with one of those pieces.
Well, yeah, but Gene, just imagine, right. Gene, of course, one of the things that Gene didn't understand, and this was something I was really glad we were able to talk about, was the fact that I said, well, Gene, how many continuous days of combat did you see? Well, he got to thinking about it and adding them up, and it wasn't a big number. I forget the exact number that he told me. But then he said, well, how many days of combat did you see where somebody was actually shooting at you? And in Vietnam, if you were a line company at the DMZ, like we were, you were getting, out of your tour, you were actually getting shot at 256 days out of that tour. So that kind of blew his mind. I said, we weren't in any huge, division against division
right.
battles like that, because the NVA just wouldn't fight us that way. They knew they couldn't win.
Right.
The only way they could win was the General Giap saying is the only way we can survive this war is to grab them by the belt so they can't bomb their own men.
Right.
And that's pretty much the way the war was.
Right. The what haven't I been smart enough to ask you about Gene Sledge that you want people to know about your friend?
He had a dry sense of humor. Gene did. I mean, Gene had he was such a bright guy, and he was witty. And somebody could say something, you know, sitting at our table, and he'd always, you know, he'd have a comeback for him. So, but you know, I attribute that to his number of years in the classroom, and everyone that I talked to just loved him as a professor of biology.
Really?
And the fact that he made learning such fun. He made learning something that they could apply. You know, not everybody in his class was going to be a doctor. In fact, you know, that university turns out, and although they do turn out a lot of doctors now, but back in those days it was primarily teachers. And but he showed them, you know, what being a good professor, a good teacher was really all about, by making it practical to what they were doing. He did love birds now. He did love birds, and as an ornithologist, and he enjoyed talking to about them. And I told him that I had a buddy that was also a Marine that worked for our company, who was a carver. He carves birds, right, of all different types.
Well, and for those of you who don't know, that is an art form that when you get in and amongst those guys, oh my God.
Oh my goodness, I tell you what. Oh, Ulyss, he carved the bald eagle that's still on display at the state park up here.
Really?
And but Gene was, I gave him Ulyss's contact information. I said, now if you really want some nice birds, I'm telling you what now, Mac, these birds look like they're alive. Realistic they are.
I have a friend that carved them, and so he wants to talk about his carvings, and I'm thinking, this is crazy. And then the more he's doing it, and the more I see, I was astounded at the shows that they have, the detail that goes into it. Absolutely, positively amazing.
Oh yeah, no question. Hey, and they're not cheap.
No,
they're not cheap.
No, they're not. The as Gene gets sick and ultimately passes, do you remember the last time you ever saw him?
Yeah, it was before I retired, and had lunch with him one day, and he wasn't sick at the time. He wasn't sick then, but that's the last time I actually got to be with him, you know, for lunch one day. I always enjoyed being able to have lunch with him. He was just, as you can tell from the interview, he was just somebody that you could talk to. If you were a Marine, I'm telling you, you know how it is. Any two Marines get together, they're going to talk.
Right.
But Gene was so interesting to talk to. He told so many funny stories about kids in his class and stuff like that. But, boy, just about every time I'd get to him, you know, he'd have a whole bunch of new questions he was wanting to ask me about Vietnam. He was so interested in Vietnam, and he said, "Well, Jack, did you see any? What kind of birds? You know, of course he had that South Alabama. What kind of birds?"
He said birds. You can hear that in the interview. I said, "What did he just say?"
Oh yeah, he don't call them birds. He calls them buoys. And I said, "Gene, I didn't see a single buoy the whole time I was over there." I said, "I saw a bunch of snakes, but I didn't see no buoys."
That is
super
funny.
Guy.
That is funny.
Super
no,
guy.
It's just, I'll tell you what. If you have not had the pleasure of listening to that conversation, they're on the website. All you got to do is type in Sledge, and you'll see the conversations with Studs Terkel. And they're absolutely wonderful, wonderful pieces. And you get get a sense of this kind of panorama of Gene Sledge. You get a little bit of his. You hear his humility, and he says, "Well, you need to tell me because I just don't want to go off talking." Blah 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 blah. You hear his humor, and this is very black combat humor. Where, and you just heard it a few minutes ago, where he says, "And then I began to make the extraction in the prescribed manner," as they used to say, right? And so.
Yeah.
And so that's Marines. They're smashing a tooth out of somebody's skull, and then they're saying that. Now, most people would say, "Oh, that's like, how could you find that even remotely humorous?" Well, you'd have to kind of be in the environment, and maybe you might be able to send that. But you hear him chuckle when he says it. And so I mean that to me is interesting. But you hear. You know, his toughness and his ferocious devotion to his fellow Marines in Kilo Company 3-5. But throughout, you hear this unbelievably intelligent, reflective man who's attempting to make, to reconcile his experience as it echoes in his life. And I think we are all much better for listening. I know I am. To his intellect, his compassion, his humility, his sense of humor, in these conversations with Stud Terkel, and I first of all, I can't say thank you enough for coming on and talking about him, Jack. But
let me share one other thing that he asked about, and you know from your earliest training days, it was always. This comment about the ranks getting too social,
right.
or back at least when I was in, the ranks were not supposed to, you know, affiliate that much off duty with lower ranks, and he said, "How was that in Vietnam?" I said. Well, that, like many of the garrison edicts that come down, that thing flew out the window the first day because, officers had talked to everybody. And in fact, one of my best friends was my platoon leader. And we talked to each other just like we were buddies. You know, I respected his rank, called him sir, but... We talk about anything. And he said, you know, that was the way it became over there. But when they were going through their training, you know, they had them to the point where they were almost afraid for a PFC to talk to a corporal. And he said, of course, just like us, they found out real quick, you know, with so many replacements coming in, they were sizing people up pretty quick and trying to understand, you know, is this person going to fit in or not? And I said, you know, Gene, one of my biggest regrets in Vietnam is that after the Battle of Gatlin's Corner, I did not even try to remember new guys' names. In fact, to this day, I could not tell you a single name of a second lieutenant other than the ones we had before the battle that lived through the battle from the other platoons. I don't remember. And we had several, but I don't remember their names. I didn't. It was like I didn't want to remember their names. He had the same feeling. And I guess it's just something that, you know, if you're going through something like he described as being, you know, you just get to, you're a savage at some points.
Well, but that is just a protective instinct.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's exactly what it is, because...
I can't take it anymore.
If
so
this guy gets gets killed, you know, I don't want the guilt on my hands, or I don't want to know him too well. I don't want to know what your girlfriend's name is, or, you know.
No, because it's too painful.
Well, while I was a squad leader, I knew everything I could about my guys. But then after I became the company sniper, it was me and Top and the skipper. Of course, I had to endure all of Top's 10,000 jokes that he would tell.
You didn't go out of your
way. That's another story.
But you didn't go out of your way to meet and know other people, and that's just a reaction to pain. But that's why these conversations, and I know Marines listen to them, Jack, and us being able to listen to now, you know, almost 90 minutes of Gene Sledge with Studs Terkel, I mean, they make you wiser in terms of your ability to anticipate, or if you've already gone through that, negotiate life afterwards, and you and he, you know, come to very, very similar, huge conclusions, in my opinion. One is you got to let your spouse into your world if you want to live a good life. And he comes to that before coming to that was cool. And you do the same thing. And then the other piece that you all both are in concert in is, you know, you've got to live your life in a way that would honor those that, you know, were with you and died.
Absolutely. And
hearing him say the same thing, you know, his father telling him, hey, you were lucky. However tough you think it was, you were lucky. You lived.
Yeah, so, I came home. That's what I told my first sergeant. He was talking about decorations, and I said, no, you know, the only decoration I want in Vietnam is I get to go home to my wife, and that was all I wanted. And that just said it all for me. And Top understood that. He was a married man that, you know, he even though he did have 10,000 jokes that, I'm not kidding you, I mean, it didn't matter what your ethnicity was, he could murder you with ethnicity jokes. And you can just imagine what I'm talking about.
Right. No, the Polacks show up, the Irish show up, the Italians show up. I mean, no, it's hilarious.
We had a Polish S2. Excuse me. He became S3, Polish S3, and we had another driver for the company that was Polish. Of course, Top just berated him with Polish jokes. But then when the S3 came over to the company office, never heard a Polish joke. Never heard a single Polish joke. Boy, did I ever rag him about that. I said, yeah, you'll tell him on old ski, but you won't go after. He said, well, I got plenty of them for him, you know, if he'd just give me a chance to talk to him. I love the guy. He was top Bryce Lee. He was another one of those frozen chosen guys.
No. Well, sir, first of all, wanted to have you on and get your thoughts on that conversation. And as I stumbled on it, it was one of those things like that I looked and like, I don't want this thing to end. And when it ended, I was like, shit, you know, I could listen to this conversation for hours. And
I am glad you found it. Every Marine should listen to it.
No, it's just a wonderful, I mean, you know, because the book is great, but to hear him in long format talking and articulating and the tone of his voice and all those things is absolutely wonderful. And so I want to thank you for coming on and talking about your friend. I know that it helps people, you know, that listen to this stuff, to hear that people that they respect and look up to. You know, I mean, when you hear that, you know, Gene Sledge, you know, asked Jack Riley, have you spoken to your wife about it? I mean, what? Wait a minute. I didn't think I was supposed to do that. Well, shit. Yeah. These guys did it? Okay, maybe I should rethink that. You know? And so anyway. All right, sir, what are your You got any big plans for the day?
Oh, yeah, big plans. I'm looking at grass out there that needs to be mowed about 5 acres worth. So,
who's mowing that?
Big plant. What do you mean, who's mowing it?
You're mowing that?
Oh, sure.
I thought a big
Why wouldn't I?
I thought a big timer like you would have that hired out.
Yeah, right. You looking at him. In fact, my foreman's looking around the corner at me and they're wondering when I'm going to
get after it. All right, well, I'll let you get after it before it gets too hot. Jack, thank you very much, as always. I appreciate it.
All right, Mac. I always enjoy talking with you.
All right, buddy.
Take care.
Yeah, have a good day. Right. Thank you.
Bye.
Semper Fidelis, out to cut the lawn. There you go. Jack Riley talking about his friend Gene Sledge. I could have these conversations all day. But you know what? Again, it just people, when I talk about post-traumatic winning and where it comes from, post-traumatic winning has a plain-spoken tone to it, and if it had an accent, it would be a Southern drawl probably, based on the number of people that come on from the South. And Jack's certainly one of them. But again, so when I say these things to people and they look at me like, wait a minute, I didn't think I was supposed to talk to my wife. Well, these two guys would tell you, yes, do that. So, pretty cool stuff. If you're just tuning in, hour one, I talk about the historical truth of fourth year Supreme Court nominations. And I will tell you, I'm astounded by what I watch on TV. And so, in 2016, Senator Mitch McConnell said, "I will not consider that. It hasn't been done when the Senate is owned by one party and the White House is owned by another. That has not been done since 1888. That is the Senate precedent. I won't break that. That will be decided after the election." Now, that's different than if the same party owns the House and the Senate. The Senate and the White House. That's happened 19 times. And except for two instances where one was thought to be corrupt and another was thought to be unqualified, every one of those nominations was confirmed. And they've been confirmed by both parties. So this... This argument is stupid. All you got to do is read a little bit of history. So I talk about that. I also play an interview that I did in 2006 after I got elected. Right. I was on the ABC News. And you're going to hear that, which is pretty interesting. So I'd never seen it. I came across it in a Zoom event last week with the National Museum of the Marine Corps. So you'll hear that and you'll. It's pretty funny. It's not funny. It's interesting, though, right after I've been elected. So anyway, on this Tuesday, have a great day. Go change somebody's life and live the things that Jack Riley and Gene Sledge talk about. So on a Tuesday, All Marine Radio, out. No, we'll be aside.